Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon.
Welcome back to News and Views. The recent police-involved shootings in St. Paul and Baton Rouge, as well as the police deaths in Dallas, have reignited the conversation about the role of race in law enforcement. News and Views producer Clayton Hinkle spoke last December with James Williams, the public defender for Orange and Chatham counties, about implicit bias, racial disparity in policing, and what can be done about it.
Let's talk a little bit about disparities in traffic stops. It's been in the news ever since the New York Times piece. It's something that you've also looked at. What are the facts? What are the numbers behind that?
Black people in particular are more likely to be stopped by the police. And once stopped, they're almost twice as likely to be searched by police. And that's statewide. There is some variation in those numbers when you look at individual police districts or cities or towns. In some areas, the search disparity rate is 3 to 4 times for blacks as opposed to whites.
We'd like to think that all policing is fair and impartial. It's not always been the case.
That is correct. I mean, first of all, I don't think that I will quarrel with the fact that I think most police departments and most police officers believe and want to do their work in a fair and impartial way. I don't suggest that the data that we're talking about indicates that there are a large number of, quote, racist police officers on police forces. What the data does indicate clearly, I think, is disparate treatment of people of different races. And a critical factor may be that of implicit bias or unconscious racism, which impacts people's decision-making process, particularly in situations where people have a lot of discretion. And one of the things about policing is that, you know, particularly as it relates to traffic stops, is that they have a huge amount of discretion. And, when you have a huge amount of discretion, implicit bias and unconscious racism is likely to creep in. And so you might have situations where someone is stopped who is a young black male. The officer analyzes or looks at the situation and they feel that something is suspicious that gives them a reason to want to search that person. So they might ask for consent to search. Where those same circumstances, if it was a white person, they would not have that sense of suspicion. Well, they may not know that that sense of suspicion is not based upon the actual facts that they are seeing, but that implicit bias that's lurking back there in their brain. And so I think those types of circumstances help drive the disparity that we see.
And so there really are consequences on both sides here. There are consequences to, taking your example, the young person who's being stopped. That one interaction may be something that sticks with him a lifetime.
That is correct. And for a person who has been through that experience, and I've talked to a number, and, you know, it is humiliating, it's demeaning. They feel that they are less than a citizen, that they don't really matter to the system. And it does, I think, impacts, you know, a person's sense of belonging to this nation, their view of what citizenship means. And I think it's a reason that we need to be really serious about trying to take corrective actions to get our policing right and try to the extent we can, get bias out of policing so that people are treated more equally.
Well, let's talk about how do you get bias out of policing. I know that's a difficult topic. We could talk about it for hours, but what are just one or two things that could be done to improve the situation?
One of the things that can be done is, you know, there are training programs that various entities, institutions have that can actually come into a department, meet with the various officers and the captains and chiefs, and actually train them on implicit bias, unconscious racism. Let them see what they may be doing that is impacted by implicit bias and unconscious racism, because it's one of those things that unless you are aware of it, you can't take protective steps to address it. But once you are conscious of it, there are certain protocols and practices that you can put in place to help alleviate it. Also, these same people can look at your policing practices in general, including deployment and things like that, that might be having disparate impacts on people of color that you as a police chief may not have even thought about in that context. So one is the training, also helping people look at data and analyze data that they've collected so that they can, if there are, for instance, quote, problem officers whose numbers are extremely disparate, that the chief can actually look at that data and then maybe talk with that person, counsel that person, try to take some corrective action that would improve the situation. But also, I mean, part of this is related to this sense of changing police culture, I think, to one of police officer as guardian and not warrior. I think one of the worst things that happened is developing language of, you know, like war on drugs or war on crime, because I think that communicates if there's a war, there's got to be an enemy. And in a country where race has been as much of a factor as it has historically in this country, then, you know, black people have traditionally been the other and the enemy, the marginalized. And I think when you're engaged in that sort of language, then it's much easier to see people of color as the target.
We heard from the police chief in Fayetteville talk about essentially, I guess, what we would call community policing.
Right.
How important is that, where people in a neighborhood get to know their local law enforcement and vice versa, where the law enforcement knows who's in that community?
Well, I think that was one of the things that when I made reference to police as guardian, that's part of what I'm talking about, because in that context, it would be more police making connections with people within the community, getting to know people in the community, and people getting to know them. That, you know, incubates trust or creates situations where officers, where citizens are much more likely to trust the police, where the police are much less likely to see citizens as the other instead of seeing them as one of them, you know, they're, you know, citizens also. And so I think that is a positive step, and I know a number of departments are looking at ways to go about doing that. And the federal government has a program that actually can assist departments. I think, in fact, it may be called COPS, with a community policing model. And another that's important, when you look at the number of black people particularly who have been subjected to either lethal or certainly deadly violence by police, that is also an extreme disproportionality. The training related to de-escalation, I think, is extremely important as it relates to fair and unbiased policing, and further training on dealing with people who may be having, you know, mental health issues and things of that nature. But this de-escalation is just so important, because quite often situations that could end without any loss of life or any use of force instead escalates into something that the officer feels requires force, when if there had been a period just stepping back and taking a breath, taking a different approach, it could have been resolved in a totally different fashion.
It's encouraging to see a number of local law enforcement agencies taking this very seriously, the New York Times article shedding light on it. What is your hope as we move forward on this issue? What would you like to see happening at the state level, whether it is a more review of the data that's coming out of UNC? What would you like to see happen?
You know, North Carolina has a good data collection statute. I heard an interview with the chief of the Greensboro Police Department, in which he said that he would like to see more data collected. And I think at least an additional piece of data that could be collected that would help is the location of stop. The statute doesn't require that. So from a legislation standpoint, that's something that might be considered. The other thing, though, is to make sure that there are entities in the state of North Carolina that do training of police, even though no departments try to do some additional training on their own. But the state entities, I would like to see them incorporate within their training on implicit bias, unconscious racism, fair and impartial policing, so that that piece is also included in the training that's provided at that level. and to see our legislature and other, you know, high-level criminal justice stakeholders be aware that this is an issue that impacts us all and also impacts people's views of the criminal justice system. How people are impacted by the police affects their view of justice in this country. And as judges, as lawyers, you know, prosecutors, we need to all take a part in trying to make sure that we improve the situation, because it's not that just the police. I mean, I know we're talking about policing, but it's a part of the whole criminal justice system, and we all are responsible for getting it right.
That's it for another edition of News and Views. Look for us on the web at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Hinkle, this is Krista Tymon. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon, Director of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com. News and Views, a weekly look at state and policy issues, is a production of the North Carolina Justice Center.